During the 20th century, there was no shortage of genocides or crimes against humanity. From the former Yugoslavia, Cambodia, and Rwanda, these horrific events are seared into history. But there is one mass crime against humanity that's been overlooked, despite being one of the most chillingly effective massacres in the 20th century, and it happened right on our doorstep. Between 1965 and 1966, Indonesia was gripped by an anti-communist purge. The Indonesian army, with the help from religious groups, orchestrated bloody massacres of leftists across the country. Within 6 months, 500,000 people were dead and hundreds of thousands were imprisoned. Indonesia's President Sukarno, who'd led the independence movement against the Dutch, was sidelined in favour of the young Major General Suharto, who led the purges, and would become the president shaping the political culture of modern Indonesia with his new order. My next guest has done painstaking new research into these crimes against humanity using documents from the CIA and the US State Department, and he's uncovered a level of international involvement in the massacres that's been buried for decades. Jeffrey B. Robinson is Professor of History at the University of California in Los Angeles. He's an expert on genocide and human rights. His new book is called The Killing Season, A History of the Indonesian Massacres, 1965 to 66. And he joins us now from LA. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Jeffrey, let's start with a little bit of context around all of this. This massacre happened in Sukarno's Indonesia. Sukarno was the independence leader who pushed out the Dutch colonial rule, yet he was pretty sympathetic to the left.
Well, that's right. And increasingly so as the 50s and 60s wore on, so that by the middle of the 1960s, he had declared a kind of alliance with Beijing and with other left-wing regimes that came as a great worry, increasingly as a worry to the United States, to the United Kingdom, and in fact, most of the Western world. He was considered too much of a leftist, although he himself was never a member of the Communist Party and declared that he himself wasn't a communist at all. But these things did happen in the context of the Cold War, really at the height of the Cold War, and that played into and helped to explain why the United States and its allies were so eager to get rid of him and also to get rid of the Communist Party, which was in Indonesia extremely popular at that time.
Why was it so popular?
The Communist Party, starting in the 1950s, had adopted a kind of populist or nationalist policy that eschewed violence. It was a legal party. It didn't have an armed wing. And it had a reputation, a growing reputation, for supporting all of the kind of anti-colonial, pro-independence, nationalist objectives that Sukarno, himself very popular, was championing. It also was much less corrupt than the alternatives, the Nationalist Party and various Islamic parties. And through the early 1960s, it gained a lot of support from civil servants like teachers and so on, but also from farmers because of the policies that it articulated and fought for.
Well, tell us about the coup on the 1st of October in 1965.
I prefer to call it an alleged coup, but we'll leave that aside.
Why do you say that?
I say that because the claim that it was a coup assumes something that we don't know for sure, which is who staged it and why did they stage it and what were their objectives. Factually speaking, what happened was that some members of the military captured and then killed six high-ranking generals of the Indonesian army. Before 12 hours had passed, the remainder of the army leadership had reacted and began to take matters into their own hands. I think the most important thing to remember is that the army, led by Major General Suharto, starting really within hours or days of the events of October 1st, used this opportunity of the killing of the generals to begin an orchestrated campaign to destroy their erstwhile enemy, which was the PKI, and also to get rid of Sukarno. They based that campaign on a claim that, in fact, has never been proven, that the generals, that the movement to kill the generals was led by the communists. That is a claim, as I say, which has not been proven. And so 500,000 people have been killed, were killed, perhaps 1 million others detained on the pretext that their party leadership had done, had killed these generals.
How did these massacres start, Jeffrey? Can you describe for us what happened?
The basic facts are quite important. As you said in your opener, about 500,000 people, quite possibly more than that, were killed in the space of about 6 months. Another 1 million detained, many of them subjected to torture, including rape. The targets of this violence were ordinary people. They were farmers, they were day laborers, civil servants, teachers, and they were targeted not for anything that they had done, but because they were members of the PKI, the Communist Party, and its affiliated organizations. And they were killed in some very gruesome ways. They were decapitated. They were castrated. They were dismembered. Their bodies and their body parts were left in public places. There were heads impaled on stakes. There were bloated corpses floating down rivers. It was pretty grim.
500,000 of them.
Yeah. And it was, there are some misunderstandings about this as well. I mean, one is that, well, this was some kind of civil war. It was not a civil war. Those who were targeted were not armed. They had not committed a crime. They belonged to what were at the time both lawful and hugely popular political and social organizations. It would be as though the Australian Labor Party one day was declared overnight unlawful, and the government at that time decided to kill or imprison all of its members and all of the organizations affiliated with it. I mean, it just kind of boggles the mind. The killing and the detentions were not spontaneous, as so many people have suggested. Particularly the Indonesian authorities claim that these were spontaneous expressions of anger against the PKI, or that this was a kind of a case of a mass running amok of Indonesians. This is simply not true. This was an army orchestrated mass killing and mass detention. How did they do this? Well, the one thing to keep in mind is that it was not done entirely by the army. This doesn't mean that the army killed everybody. What they did was they mobilized militia groups, some of them nominally civilian militia groups, youth groups that had been affiliated with, that were affiliated with different political parties. They mobilized them, they gave them weapons, they gave them license to kill, indeed encouraged them to kill communists or to round up communists for detention. So the way it worked was that the army gave the orders, gave weapons, provided trucks, provided places of detention, and provided a kind of encouragement for these anti-communist groups to go after tens, hundreds of thousands of their political opponents.
And as you've explained, this would have come as a hell of a shock for the people. So I wonder, what did the broader general public know about the massacres at the time as it was unfolding?
Well, interestingly, at the very outset, because they were involved in lawful political organizations, many members of the PKI and affiliated organizations didn't imagine that anything bad would happen to them because they hadn't done anything. And so when they were asked to volunteer, in certain instances, a military officer would come to a village and say, who here is a member of the Communist Party or of the Communist Peasant League? They would raise their hands and then be led away and never to be seen again. So the initial reaction was, well, not to do anything really, but to because the expectation was, as a very popular party, nothing could happen to them. The other thing that happened as the days passed is that people began to be affected by a very deliberate army campaign of propaganda that was devised and designed in order to encourage fear of what the communists might have done or might yet do, and to encourage a kind of revulsion and anger toward the PKI and its affiliates. And this propaganda included, for example, the completely false claim that the at the moment of the killing of the six generals, communist women, members of the communist women's organization called Gerwani, had danced around the generals, cackling like witches, dancing half naked, and had sliced their genitals with razor blades.
Goodness.
And gouged their eyes out. So this was a deliberate lie. Of course, it was known to be a lie, but it was put about through the army press and on the radio and in official announcements and repeated endlessly until it percolated down to virtually every village. And there was, quite naturally, people were angry and fearful, and they were much more ready to take action against the PKI because this propaganda had created such fear and revulsion in the population.
This is LNL on RN. You can download the show wherever you get your podcasts, or you can listen, of course, on the ABC app. I'm Liz Jackson, filling in for Philip Adams. And my guest is historian and genocide expert Jeffrey B. Robinson, an author who has written a gripping new account of the massacre of 500,000 Indonesian leftists in the 1960s. Jeffrey, one of the most chilling aspects of your book was a level of US knowledge and collusion in these massacres. What exactly did they know and do?
Yeah, I think you're right. That is one of the most chilling aspects. You know, there are really two parts of this. One, which I won't spend too much time on, which is that in the period before 1965, for at least a decade, the United States had been trying to get rid of Sukarno and trying to destroy or weaken or undermine the PKI. So that's the background. And so it was not really a surprise when the opportunity arose in early October 65 to accomplish those things that the United States played such an active and enthusiastic role in aiding and abetting the violence. So the U.S., together with the United Kingdom, and I should say also with their allies, which would include, you know, my own country, Canada, and Australia, and New Zealand. Yes, indeed, Australia and New Zealand, and many others beside. But primarily the United States and the United Kingdom as ringleaders. They provided secret assurances almost immediately to Suharto and his people that should they decide to move harshly against the PKI, they could be confident that the United States and its allies would do nothing. So there was this secret kind of political backing. They sent these messages directly to Suharto and his closest allies in the army, providing them assurances that they could move ahead. The second thing that they did was to provide various kinds of aid. They provided food aid, but also cotton and medicines and money. It's inconclusive, but there's some evidence that they provided additional military aid. They certainly provided communications equipment that was made possible the orchestration or coordination of the campaign. And what is really striking about this is that this aid, of course, it had to be done covertly. So it didn't appear that the United States was pulling the strings. Even Suharto did not want to be tarred with that brush because he wanted to portray himself as a nationalist. In the documents, you see that the United States says, well, we must do this secretly, but we certainly must do it. And so the aid is being provided on a covert basis, consistently as the killings are being carried out. But maybe even more chillingly, more and more aid is provided precisely as the army becomes more effective and more determined and more successful in its killing.
Now, Okay, yeah. Sorry to interrupt you, Geoffrey. I want to ask you, though, because you've mentioned Australia. We're obviously very interested in Australia's position in all of this. So officially, what was the Australian line on this alleged coup?
They took the position that mimicked the official Indonesian position, which was that the coup was orchestrated by the PKI, the coup attempt or the failed coup was orchestrated by the PKI, and that the reaction against it was a regrettable but inevitable consequence of the PKI having overstepped, and that Suharto, in a sense, was a kind of savior, that Suharto and the army did what they had to do to rescue the country from this terrible crisis.
And Geoffrey, what about the role of the international media in all of this when this was happening? Well, where were they?
That's very interesting as well, because overwhelmingly, the position adopted by governments and by the media was either one of complete silence. This was a deliberate policy of the United States. They said, our policy is to keep quiet, even as we know that the violence is happening. The media wasn't quite as supine as that, but they tended, and I'm thinking here, you know, about the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I'll say a bit about Australian papers in a moment, but they adopted very much the official line, and the reason for that was that they were many of them, not all, but many of them were going to briefings in Jakarta that were provided by the army, where the official army version was peddled. But more importantly, and here's where the Australian angle comes in, all of the embassies, including the Australian, were working very hard to make sure that their daily papers and their weeklies were being fed the official Indonesian line. And this is in the documents. That they're quite proud of the fact, the Australian Foreign Ministry, they're quite proud of the fact that they have been able to get to the editorial offices of all the major dailies and convince them to adopt what is effectively a fake or a false narrative about what was happening.
Extraordinary situation. Yeah. So, Geoffrey, 500,000 people dead. No one has ever been called to account for the massacres. Former political prisoners who spent many years in jail, they haven't been pardoned. How does all of this play out in Indonesian society today?
You know, to a remarkable extent, it is still completely unresolved. I speak about how little the story is understood outside. Even in Indonesia, if one compares this event with virtually any of the large mass killings or genocides of the late 20th century, this is the one where there has been least in the way of any effort at reconciliation, memorialization, forensic investigation. There's been no meaningful judicial process. It really is quite extraordinary. And the reason is quite simple, and that is that the perpetrators of this violence remained in power for four decades. And so it was they who have called the shots and written the history. Now, the good news is that in the last, I would say, 10 years or so, this has started slowly to change. Now there are some journalists, there are some academics, there are certainly artists and novelists and painters who are starting to eat away at and really weaken and undermine and challenge the official narrative. But we are still incredibly far away from the point where Indonesia will ever have a memorial such as the memorials at Auschwitz. We are so far away from anything like the tribunal in Cambodia. It's a distant dream. It may be a generation or two before that can happen. Even a simple, a seemingly straightforward and humane act like trying to properly bury the remains of a PKI member whose body was thrown into a ditch or a mass grave excites the most extraordinary conflict, and it's something that very few people are prepared even to risk because the opposition to it, even down to the local level, is so strong from anti-communist militia groups and social groups and religious groups. It's a long road ahead.
It is an extraordinary story, Geoffrey. Thank you so much for telling us that story here today. And Jeffrey Robinson's book is called The Killing Season, A History of the Indonesian Massacres, 1965 to 66, rather. It's published by Princeton University Press.